right. Well, again, welcome to Hope Lower Town. And those of you who don't know me, my name is Brian. There might be some of you who have maybe started coming or have been here for a couple months that you've never heard me speak, and that's maybe a good thing. Just want to say thank you, honestly, to everyone who's in here right now. If you are, you know, consider yourself part of Hope Lower Town, and that I couldn't have done it without you, without your support, without your patience, without fill in the blank. It was really good. So I just want to talk about it briefly, and then again, what sabbatical just means, it just kind of took a little bit of a break. It wasn't 12 weeks of vacation. There were some projects that I was working on, which I'll talk a lot more about next week, which hopefully will be clear. Just wanted to point out a couple things and a couple thank yous. One was just to Sarah Mischke, and Patrick as well, but they were just really instrumental and helpful. They kind of helped get prayer teams organized to pray for me over that sabbatical, and I felt that. I know a lot of you gave, and just to collect some gift cards for some restaurants for Angela and I to be able to go to, which was great. And so thankful for that. Pastor Steve, the senior pastor of Hope Community Church, he made this frame for me, and Sarah's sister did this, and it's one of my favorite verses in the Bible from Job, which we're going to talk about a little bit. Pastor Steve preached to Job last week, but it hangs up on our wall, right? I know that you can do all things, that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. It was a very instrumental verse in my life. We got to take a couple trips. Angela and I got to go down to Cancun during a tropical storm, which was fantastic. No, there was a couple breaks every day. It was actually really nice. It was a good time. We had a really good time together down there. And then our family recently went out to Colorado, went down to Colorado Springs, and really had a good time out there. We went on to our family camp, which we normally do over the 4th of July. Went down to my mom's and, you know, broke my hand. Good times. Did a little bit of a writing retreat. I don't want to necessarily say I'm working on a book, but I'm kind of been working on a book, just kind of getting some thoughts of mine down. And that was great. Just able to take a couple days and get some writing and processing down and a lot of other things. So you can talk to me more about that. And one was looking at small groups at Lower Town and just looking at it from a different lens. And so I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that. Nothing crazy. If you're a small group leader, you're like, what's happening? Don't worry about it. I will fill you in on that. We are in this series called Wisdom and Songs, this kind of gospel mixtape, which has been kind of cool that each speaker has been able to kind of just kind of choose and pick something from the wisdom books or the songs, which are the wisdom just being Job, Ecclesiastes, and Proverbs, and then the songs of Psalms, the Psalms, and then also the Song of Solomon and the Song of Songs. And looking at those five poetic books and wisdom literature, we've kind of just picked and chose. And so I get to do that now. And so I really want to look at and focus on the book of Ecclesiastes today, and which is, I'm going to be spending 2 weeks on this, which I'll talk about a little bit more. But when I was a kid, my dad had two favorite movies. It was back in the day when we would go to Blockbuster. Remember that? We'd go to Blockbuster, and my dad, when he would go to Blockbuster to pick out a movie, he would always come back with one of two movies. And one of them was Big with Tom Hanks, and then the other one was Groundhog Day with Bill Murray. I mean, it was one of these two. I mean, every time. We had to watch these movies, I mean, dozens of times. I felt like we watched these all the time. And the whole point of Groundhog Day, it came out in 1993, which I know a lot of you weren't even born yet when this movie came out. But we used to watch this all the time. And the whole point, the whole premise of it, there's been other renditions of it. 13, no, that's Big, would be 13 going on 30. Anyways, there's been other renditions of just someone being stuck in time, right? I'm going to experience the same day, and Bill Murray experiences Groundhog Day over and over and over. And like the cult weird nerd following of Groundhog Day says that he spent 3 decades, I guess, I don't know where they figured that out, of going through the same day over and over. And it wasn't until he becomes content with his circumstances that he finally gets out of Groundhog Day, whatever. It's a whole thing. You can look at it, but that's kind of Ecclesiastes. It's kind of what the book of Ecclesiastes is talking about, of the monotony of life, or we're just doing the same thing over and over and over. My alarm goes off. I get up. I go to work. I come home, I go to bed, and I do it over and over and over. Ecclesiastes is a favorite book of two of my heroes, one being R.C. Sproul, the other being my dad. That's little baby Brian in that photo. This is my dad and me when obviously I was just born. And then R.C. Sproul, who I never met. But they are heroes of mine. And this is one of their favorite books. R.C. Sproul shares a story that he was actually led. He came to faith through the book of Ecclesiastes, that he was an atheist. He was in college. He wanted nothing to do with God, but he was a philosopher. He was a thinker. And there's a random verse in this book that talks about how a tree falls in the woods and it lands in the ground and nobody cares, right? And for some reason, he was like, I need Jesus. And he would joke that he is probably the only person in the history of humanity to come to faith through that verse. But he's a philosopher. My dad, not so much a philosopher, but he loved the idea of this book of whoever the author is. I'm going to argue that it probably was Solomon. Maybe not, but we'll look at that. That he goes through all these experiments of life and the monotony of life and the wisdom that this author gives us, and then eventually concludes that we need to worship God. And my dad loved that idea, and so it was one of his best, but it reads as a 19th or 20th century philosophy book. It sounds like Kierkegaard, or it sounds like Barthes, if you're familiar with those names, and if you're not, it's okay. It's okay. It's not a big deal. But it reads of like, what is the meaning and the purpose of life? Why do we do this over and over again? Its logic and its prose from this book is used in popular culture, not pop culture. That would be very popular. I'll get into that a little bit. Ben made a joke a couple weeks ago that we really keep up with the times, like 1993 movies. And then another even older one, of Ernest Hemingway, wrote a book called The Sun Also Rises. Anyone ever read that book? Probably, a few of you, okay, several. And the whole point of this book is just meaningless, right? These explorers go out and they spend their money and they just live life however they want to live it, and there's not really any point. And that is Ernest Hemingway's whole point. Is he's like, there's meaningless, there's nothing here. The sun rises also, it just keeps going around and around and around. That life is just a cruel joke. Some people are born with wealth and some people aren't. There's no point whatsoever. And the ultimate winner of the whole thing is death. And he even chooses to end his own life, to take some semblance of control, even in his death. The sun also rises, maybe a little bit more popular, a little bit newer. Still, you know, they just made the live action. They're making a Mufasa movie right now, which I'm really excited about. But they're gonna hopefully they don't ruin the lore of Mufasa in my mind. What is the point of this? Circle of life. There it is. Let's stay on track here, right? There's a circle of life. Right, this whole point, right? There's a scene where Simba and Mufasa, they're up on that thing, and he's like, oh, look, everything where the ground touches, right, is yours. And he's like, hey, we're lions, we're the best, we're cool. And he's like, yeah, but someday you're gonna die and you're gonna turn into grass and the antelope are gonna eat you, right? This is just a circle of life. It's just cyclical. What goes around comes around. And this is kind of the idea of philosophy, of karma, if you will, right? This never-ending rat race. And that's what the book of Ecclesiastes is trying to get after. Is this just over and over monotony? And is there any point to any of this? I actually looked up, just for fun, August 25th, which is that's today, of 1985. I just chose that year because that was the year I was born, and that was the best year ever, obviously. And so looking at August 29th, 1985, looking at the headlines of the newspaper, back then, they sound the same. Right? History repeats itself. I was going to just read them, but it's the same thing. That the main topics of that newspaper were racism, tension with Russia, and inflation. Well, nothing's changed. Nothing has changed. It's wild. So the author of Ecclesiastes, excuse me, not the author, but the writer, narrator, this is the teacher, I'll get into the voices here in a minute, says this. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. And you're all thinking, welcome back, Pastor Brian. I guess you had a really good sabbatical, huh? I did. So I'm going to do a two-part series of this. And this week, just kind of looking at what's the point? What's the point of life? What is the meaning of this? Is there any meaning? And I'm going to, you know, get a little bit of an answer, but next week is going to be a lot more practical. This week, a little bit more theoretical philosophy. And then next week will be a lot more practical. And I'll get there because I know, you know, not everyone comes to church every week. Sinners. I'm kidding. So let's look at this. What's the point? What's the point of the book, right? The author is going to get at this. Why am I doing this? What are we here for? I mean, really. And we've all been there. We've all been to this point to ask ourselves the question, why am I doing this? Why am I doing the 9 to 5? I work 5 days a week. I labor, I toil. Why? So I can have one day to myself and then... Is it really to myself? No, I'm doing projects around the house or I'm hanging out with friends that I don't even really want to hang out with, right? What are we doing? What is the point of this? Or you live for the weekend or fill in the blank. Is that really all there is? Is it just a rat race? Is it just the next promotion? Is it just the next kid or a marriage or this next party? Or what is it? What is the point? And the author, or at least the teacher here, is going to say and ask those questions that there must be more to life. There's got to be. It is a human question that I think every human being has asked, either from a young age or recent. Why do I got to go to school all the time? Just the other day, he was like, Dad, can I design my own video game? I'm like, well, yeah, if you go to school for graphic design and blah, blah, blah. He's like, no, I want to do it now. Well, sorry, kid. You know what I mean? You got to be in school for the next 20 years if you want to design video games, right? Maybe not, but he doesn't need to know that. That's what this book is about. It is asking the questions about a cry of futility. That's Ecclesiastes. Theology cannot be formed on an island. Excuse me. Let me correct that. Good theology cannot be formed on an island. Right? If any of you went home and you lock yourself in a closet and you study your Bible and you come back to me and you say, Brian, I found some new theology that's going to change everything, I'm going to say, stop there, you're wrong. I don't even care what you say, it's wrong. There needs to be peer review when it comes to theology, and it's also true of wisdom literature. These are meant to provide different angles and aspects of wisdom within the Bible, and so these are just some silly personification images of these books. Right, but you have the book of Proverbs, wisdom, Lady Wisdom, that if you do good and you pursue wisdom and righteousness, good things will happen. If you don't, if you lie in wait with wicked people, then bad things and blood will be spilt is going to happen to you. That good, bad, right? Well, but hang on a second, right? And the author of Ecclesiastes is going to say that. Well, but that doesn't always work. Just because I'm good doesn't mean good things happen. And just because I'm bad doesn't mean bad things happen. Life is not fair. So what's going on here? So it can't just be Proverbs. And then you have Job. Again, Pastor Steve looking at this last week of saying, wow, this guy, he's the most righteous man in the world. God even brings him up. Hey, Satan, have you considered my servant Job? And then Satan goes and destroys everything. And at the end of it, I know that no plan of yours can be thwarted. God, you are going to do what you're going to do. And if we just look at Job on an island, then God is a tyrant. He's evil in some ways. We could probably land that. But he's not. We have to look at all the perspectives. And I've heard Job taught, and Steve didn't even get there last week, at the end of the book of Job, that Job loses 10 kids and all of the things. At the end of the book, he's rewarded. Some people will say with twice as much. He has 20 kids. And he's got more than twice of all the cattle and everything. That's not a reward. He lost 10 kids. And I would imagine if you interviewed Job and asked, would you have rather had your original 10 kids or have them all die and be replaced with 20 others, what would you choose? He would say, for sure, I'd rather have the 10. What are you talking? That's not it. And the whole point of Job is saying, God is going to do what God's going to do. God didn't punish Job for any ill doing on Job, and he didn't reward Job for Job doing anything right. God's in control. And then you have the third perspective, this third vantage point in the wisdom of God, asking, is there any point of this? Round and round we go under the sun. And the book is going to deal with the anomalies of life, the injustices, the unfairness. There's a, now we're getting into pop culture here. Ready for this? Look at this, Benson Boone. I think he's popular right now. I don't know. He's on the radio. I drive a 30-year-old truck, so I have a radio. And he's on the radio quite a bit. And I don't listen to lyrics a lot. I'm one of the people that hears the melody, and I'm like rocking out to the melody. And then someone's like, well, do you have any idea what that song's about? No, I have absolutely no clue. But there's something about when I hear scripture in a song, I do listen to it. Like, whoa, what are we talking about here? And he goes through, I mean, direct quotes from Job and Ecclesiastes in the song of the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. But he said, the song is called Beautiful Things. And he says, God, please. No, he doesn't say please. He has a demanding spirit. He says, God, don't take these beautiful things that I love. Don't take these beautiful things from me. But then we have this Ecclesiastes view. He says, I found my mind. I'm feeling sane. It's been a while, but I'm finding my faith. If everything's good and it's great, why do I sit and wait till it's gone? Have you ever been there? Ever been like, man, I feel like life is going kind of good right now. When's the hammer going to fall? And I broke my hand. Does that reset the injustice in my life? What are we doing here? He says, oh, I tell you, I know I've got enough. I've got peace and I've got love, but I'm up at night thinking I just might lose it all. Oh God, don't take these beautiful things that I got. This is human struggle. If God is in control and does what he wants, then what is the point? I'm just supposed to give God glory because he's God? Sounds a little narcissistic to me. What's the point of this? So let's look at this meaningless life. Welcome back, Brian. Ecclesiastes 1 through 9 says, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. So there's two voices in this book. One is the author, the writer, the narrator, if you will, and the other is the teacher, or the preacher, sometimes it's translated. That you have the teacher, the writer, the author here saying, there's a teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. There's speculation. Was this Solomon? Was this not? I lean that this is Solomon. Solomon was apostate. He worships hundreds of different gods. He has, 700 wives, 300 concubines. He lives this licentious life, builds temples to other gods. And I think that this book is at the end of his life, and he's writing the wisdom that he's learned and gained. But because he says, at one point, there's reason why people would say, I don't know if this is Solomon, because he's going to say that he was the wisest who ever led in Jerusalem. And then some people say, well, that means that's a dig on his dad, because he's only number two in line as a king in Jerusalem. Okay, so I don't know if that was Solomon, but to make that statement, I think it is. And to see that this king in Jerusalem gets whatever he wants, whenever he wants it, it falls in line with Solomon. It doesn't necessarily have to be Solomon, but I would argue that it would be. Don't lose anything if it's not necessarily. But then we have this other teacher, and we're going to see this teacher experiment with life. I'm going to go out, I'm going to get everything I want, when I want it, how I want it, and even more so than what I wanted. And I'm going to arrive at the same conclusion, it's all meaningless. What's the purpose of life? So what is this? What does he say? Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? Again, that under the sun phrase will be used quite a bit. But what is this word meaningless? If you have your Bible open, I'm reading from the NIV, which is meaningless. Really good translation. And yet, it's not actually the literal meaning. The King James and some other translations actually translate that word vanity. right? Maybe some of you have a vanity mirror. Yesterday I was at Walmart with my daughter and there was like a little Barbie vanity thing. Like I was like, oh, I didn't know that was still like a popular thing. It is vanity, right? And normally when we hear the word vanity, we think, oh, it's vain, right? Like you just want to look at yourself, but a vanity mirror is that, right? I'm looking at myself. I'm going to put my makeup on. At the end of the day, I'm going to take it all off. That it's all in vain in some way, right? And that's kind of the idea of vanity. It's fleeting. It's passing. That's a good word. It's meaningless, but it's not the literal meaning of this word. The literal meaning, the Hebrew word, which doesn't really matter, but is the word hevel. And hevel just simply literally means mist or smoke. It's something that I can see. It's there and I can touch it. I can interact with it, but then it's gone. It's a mist. It's a vapor. It's smoke. Literally, right? Vapor, breath. And then translated specifically here of what is evanescent. I had to Google that. Google didn't even know what that word was because it was spelt differently. It just means unsubstantial, worthless, and vanity, okay? And so there's all just this aspect of it's just fleeting. It's just passing. But there's something here, right? The author's trying to get us a little bit more detail. It's poetry, so he's using a literal word in a literal and figurative way about life. In Isaiah, the word hevel is used 86 times, 39 times here in Ecclesiastes, and this word is translated most often when it's not in the book of Ecclesiastes, not as meaningless or vanity, but as breath or wind or smoke. So, for example, in verse 13, when you cry out for help, let your collection of idols save you. Actually, in Jeremiah, the word hevel is translated to idols as something worthless. The wind will carry all of them off. A mere breath will blow them away. So that word breath there is hevel. But whoever takes refuge in me will inherit the land and possess my holy mountain. Not interested necessarily in the verse and what it context around it, but just that word, that it's used breath and vapor. But here the author of Ecclesiastes is going to change that. It's not just smoke. The wise teacher is using this literal definition to help us understand our lives, right? Smoke is real. Mist, when I'm in fog, it's very real. It's tangible, but not. What's the point, right? It's here and it's gone. I can't really grab it. It's fleeting. What's the point of a hevel life? He's going to go on and he's going to describe this. Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. An eye has never enough of seeing, or an ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again, and what has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. In this meaningless, hevel life of mine, I have seen both of these, that the righteous perish in their righteousness, and the wicked living long in their wickedness. Now, this is a contrast to Proverbs. The author of Proverbs, this wisdom, is going to say things like, honor your father and mother, and your days on life will be long. If I honor my parents, well, then I'll have a long life. The Bible teaches this. The problem is this is a proverb. This is not a promise of God. And when it's taught like a promise, then we go, this is meaningless. What is the point of this? I remember when I was younger, I was 14, my father had died from cancer, and I remember we had some preacher came to the church, and I remember he was preaching in Proverbs on that exact verse, honor your father and mother. And I remember going to him afterwards, and I said, you said if you honor your father and mother, your days on earth will be long. My dad did that. How come he died? And he was like, well, maybe he was spared from another untimely death that would have happened earlier on he did live longer than what he should have because he honored his mom and dad. That is not what the Proverbs are talking about. It's not a promise. This is just wisdom. And wisdom says, if I listen to my parents, I will probably not kill myself with some stupid accident when I'm a little kid, right? That's wisdom. It's not a promise. So he's speaking differently to that. He's saying, I see righteous people dying in their righteousness, and I see wicked people living long on the earth. The teacher here is saying it doesn't always work out for Lady Wisdom. So the author then says, life is meaningless, so live it up. Let's go. Let's party. That's the whole point of life. Let's just go out and have fun and experiment and do whatever our hearts desire. And then we will be satisfied. And so this teacher is going to do that. This is what's called hedonism, the experience of pleasure of anything I could possibly desire. And let me say this, that pleasure is the narcotic of choice of people who have no hope. Pleasure is the narcotic of choice of people who have no hope. They just simply want to get to the next thing. Let's get to the weekend, right? TGIF, right? Margaritaville, let's go. Because if there's no meaning, then why not just have fun? Or go Ernest Hemingway and the nihilist idea of just then what's the point? Might as well just end it. There's a paradox, though, within hedonism that we all know, and I'm sure some of you or all of us have experienced at some point, that I want that thing out there, and so I'm going to pursue it, and when I get it, I feel empty. It didn't satisfy, right? There's infamous videos of athletes and politicians who went and got the thing that they so badly desired, and they get it, and they achieve it, and then they go, is that really all there is? I mean, it was fun for a minute, but that's it. Or the opposite, we can't achieve it and therefore get frustrated. It's a paradox. And we all fall prey to this hedonistic lifestyle and these hedonistic experiments, just like the teacher. We say, if I could just get to that next thing. Remember being in high school? Remember thinking, oh man, once I get out on my own, once I go to college, then I will be good. And then you get to college or you get out on your own and you go, oh yeah, but if I could just get to the next thing, if I could just have a good job and have some disposable income, then I will be set. And then maybe you get that, maybe you don't. Maybe you say, yeah, but I feel a little empty inside. So man, if I could just get married, if I could just have some kind of relationship that would fill that void. And then you get that relationship and you realize, that didn't do it. Well, maybe if I just have kids and it just goes on and on and on. It's a rat race. What is the point? It doesn't satisfy. It might for just a fleeting moment, but then it's gone. So live it up. The teacher says this. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit and trees in them. I made reservoirs of water, groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself from the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward of my toil. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was hevel, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Nothing was gained under the sun. Solomon experiments and he succeeds. When we read this, there's no one in this room who has done all of that. And he says, what's the point? I did everything. I mean, I was the greatest human being on this planet and it's empty. He exceeds with his experiments. He attains everything and he says, it's hevel. So this phrase, under the sun, this beautiful graphic I made just for you. You're on earth, that's you, that represents your little smiley face, under the sun. The size scale is accurate, by the way. It's in the foreground, okay? We're under the sun. The whole perspective of it is life under the sun, on this life of this circular life of round and round and round we go. The teacher here is going to say it's all been done before. That's what under the sun means. And matter of fact, the apostle Paul is going to use the same kind of language in 1 Corinthians 15:32. He's going to say, hey, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. He quotes Ecclesiastes. He says, let's go ahead and do that. Let's just eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. If Jesus isn't who he says he is. If Jesus, the one who claimed to be God in the flesh, didn't rise from the dead, then yeah, you know what? There is no point. So let's just go party. And he says, and he's going to go further. We of all people are to be pitied. Christians aren't usually known for having a good time. He's saying, this is a waste. If Jesus doesn't rise from the dead, what is the point of this? If Jesus isn't who he said he was, then this is hell. Right, again, philosophy is going to say this is a circle of life. This is karma. Round and round and round we go. But the Jewish timeline is very different. It's linear. It's going to start the book within the beginning. It's going to have a start, and it's going to go to the end of humanity, not humanity, but the end of this earth, when God's going to make all things new for all of eternity. But there's this end, if you will. And what the author of Ecclesiastes is going to get to eventually is to say it's not just about the beginning. It's not just about looking to the end. We do, as Christians, look forward to that. He's saying, but there's a here and there's a now. There's something tangible. There is meaning to this life. There is a point to this. There's a point to the dash, right? Well, I've kind of been to a graveyard, and we've seen that. Someone born on a date, and they die on a date. And there's this little dash in between, right? We can get all cool and philosophical. And what does that dash mean in your life? What the author of Ecclesiastes is saying, is there any point to that dash? And he's saying, yes, yes, there is. This isn't just a circle that goes round and round. There's going to be a Christian view of time and life under the sun. And even though Christ wasn't a thing at this point, he's looking forward to a day, which we'll see next week, the conclusion of the whole matter. But in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, 1 and 2, he's going to go to the future. He's saying, a good name is better than fine perfume, the day of death better than the day of birth. It is better to go into the house of mourning than to go into the house of feasting. For death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. There is going to be an end date. There is going to be a finish on our lives on this earth, but there's going to be a future as well. And that's why it matters. But then he's going to go to the other side of it in the past. He said, do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions. So much of our thoughts rest and focus on the future, the next step. If I could just achieve this next thing, and then, man, the good old days. For me, it was, remember when you were 6'2", when you were 12, and you were dunking in junior high on people? But man, remember those days? That was fun. That was a good time. I can't even touch the net anymore. That's true. So much of our thoughts dwell on the future and the past. But there's going to be a shift in the tone, in the tenor, in the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 3. We're going to say there is a time for everything and a season for every activity. What does he say here? Under the sun? He changes perspective here now. Under the heavens. There's a different perspective. We're going to get beyond the sun and the circularness of life on earth. And we're going to look and view at life from God's perspective. And then everything changes. Everything has meaning. Who sings this song? Old timers? Who sings this? A time. Da, 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 da. Who? The Birds? Oh. The Birds sing this song. Pop culture, again. Thank you, Vicky. A time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant, a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down, a time to build, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather them, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to search and a time to give up, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to see or time to mend, a time to be silent, a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. The author here is saying there's more to life under the sun that pleasure cannot answer, because we're not looking at this from under the sun. We look at life from God's perspective, from the heavens, and then life has meaning. That dash all of a sudden takes on a new meaning. There's wisdom in here on how to act in a certain way at a certain time. We're not just looking left to right and looking forward to just the future. It's not just that. But most of us, again, operate that way. I know I do, and I have about even just this church, of saying, man, I would love it. Let's look forward to the day. Let's dream about the day when the seats and the pews are packed with people and we just do all this. But what if God doesn't have that in store? If we just pursue that and say, man, I want, at a good reason, I want to see seats filled because I want people to learn about Jesus and to be baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And then I want to make disciples of them. That I want, that's a good desire. That's a good thing. But what if God doesn't allow that to happen? Are we okay and content in the here and now? Are we okay giving glory to God when we don't get our way and our wishes and our wants and desires? And if we don't ever get that, then guess what? We get to grow old together as friends and as family. And I'll take that. Sounds great. A Christian view of time and life under the sun: time is given purpose under heaven. The temporal has meaning from the right perspective. Right, we just read about what's the appropriate behavior at the right time. This is wisdom from God. Life has meaning and purpose, even in the monotony of life. Right, we looked at last week that life has purpose, that no suffering suffering is not meaningless, but even just the monotony of life is not meaningless. Recently, my family, we watched this movie, Pollyanna. I had never seen it before. My wife watched this growing up. By this little girl who's just happy all the time in spite of her circumstances. And I am so sweaty right now. Is everyone else distracted by that, or is it just me? I'm just going to call it out. Okay, just me. Woo-hoo-wee. All right, good. I'm glad I wore a gray shirt so my sweat doesn't show up. I won't turn around so you can see my back. Goodness. Woo. Pollyanna is this little girl who's just happy about everything. In spite of her circumstances, and then they ask her, because people start to get annoyed with her. Pollyanna, you're always so happy. How do you do that? Or why do you do that? She goes, oh, I play the glad game. Right? I just play the glad game. No matter what's going on in my life, I can look at what's happening right in front of me, and I can be thankful and be happy about this thing right in front of me. That's great and good, and we could end it right here and say, hey, in spite of your circumstances, in spite of your monotony, just play the glad game, and we'll be good. No. And the Ecclesiastes even talks, it doesn't work that way. You can't just pretend to be happy. And the word happy just means, is the etymology, is happenstance. It's based on my circumstances. I can't make myself happy. But to be filled with joy in who Christ is and what he's going to do and what he is doing in my life and what he has done, now that's different. Life has meaning, but it's not always about, I'm not always happy. I'm not always glad. I can't always play the glad game. At the end of the movie, she falls from a house and becomes a paraplegic, and the whole town comes and sees her, and they're carrying her out. Well, she's not playing the glad game at the end of the movie. Although they do put, on the name of the town, they put a new sign, City of Glad, as she's being taken to the doctor. Happy ending. It's not just about being glad all the time, because we're not. Hard things happen. I want to read just a quick quote here from a philosopher from the 1600s, French philosopher and Catholic writer named Blaise Pascal. He says this: we never keep to the present. This is his writing about a summary of Ecclesiastes. He says, we never keep to the present. We recall the past. We anticipate the future as if we found it too slow in coming and we're trying to hurry it up. We recall the past as if to say it's too rapid flight. We are so unwise that we wander about in times that do not belong to us and do not think of the only one that does. So vain that we dream of times that are not and blindly flee the only one that is. The fact is that the present usually hurts. We thrust it out of sight because it distresses us. And if we find it enjoyable, we are sorry to see it slip away. we try to give it support of the future and think of how we are going to arrange things over which we have no control for a time we can never be sure of reaching. Let each of us examine his thoughts. He will find them wholly concerned with the past or the future. We almost never think of the present, and if we do think of it, it is only to see what light it throws at our plans for the future. The present is never our end. The past and the present are our means, and the future alone our end. Thus, we never actually live, but hope to live. And since we are always planning how to be happy, it is inevitable that we should never be so. There's wisdom in that. Similarly, Herman Melville, author of Moby Dick in the 1800s, says this: until we understand that our grief outweighs a thousand joys, we will never understand what Christianity is all about. Christianity isn't just getting Jesus and therefore getting everything my heart desires. It doesn't work that way. God is not a genie in a bottle. Matter of fact, in a lot of ways, he's the opposite. He teaches Paul and tells Paul, I'm going to show you now the ways you must suffer for my name's sake. You're going to follow me. There's a cost of discipleship. And it's not just good. You're going to be doing good, and then you're going to suffer. You're going to see people doing wickedness, and you're going to see them prosper. Does that mean it's worthless? Does that mean it's pointless? Not even close. So the point of all of this is just to give God the glory just because he's God? No. No, the chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. He is a God worthy of worship. He is a God worthy of praise. It is what some theologians have coined Christian hedonism, that I receive my joy and my pleasure and my satisfaction from Jesus and from his gospel. Does it mean I'm always happy? No. Does it mean I'm always glad? No. But man, am I full of joy because of who God is and what he has done for me. Again, the practical side we'll look at next week, but just in conclusion, gospel application, God doesn't waste human suffering, and not just pain and suffering, not just pain or loss, but even the monotony of toiling. He doesn't waste that. There's a purpose and a point in that dash, in the here and now, and Jesus is here with you. That our God is a God who doesn't just see our struggles. He doesn't just observe us from above and say, I'm sorry about that. Too bad. Hey, I'm here for you if you need me. He doesn't just do that. He doesn't just stay separate and unapproachable. He enters into our space, the incarnation. He takes on flesh and he becomes human. You all know that I love the show and the series, The Chosen. And there's this, in this past season, there's a few different times in season 4 where Jesus is there and he's talking about his disciples, and people say their lack of faith and their struggle of believing that he's the Messiah. And then someone says, yeah, they're just human. And Jesus, with tears in his eyes, he says, I'm human too. The scene where Jesus weeps over the death of Lazarus is gut-wrenching. Jesus was human. He doesn't just see and observe our suffering and our pain and the monotony of toiling. Do you think Jesus didn't feel that way? You think he didn't just do everything he possibly did? And then at the end, he's dying on the cross and all of his disciples are gone except John. You think he wasn't nailed to the cross saying, what was the point of this? If they're just going to abandon me, what was the point? He gets it and he gets us. He literally gets us. He died an unfair death and shed his blood for our sins, not his. Our God is going to judge from an eternal perspective. Next week, we'll look at the conclusion of the matter. It's going to talk about the judgment of God, things done in secret and things that will be rewarded. But he's going to judge from an eternal perspective. And someday we're going to stand before him. Every single one of us are going to stand before that judge. And he's going to say, depart from me, I never knew you. Or he's going to look at us because he sees us in light of what Jesus has done. And he's going to say, well done, thou good and faithful servant. And in that moment, all of our heartache and our pains, our suffering, the emptiness in our soul that we feel at times, the monotony that we feel in our being is going to be made right. It's going to be mended. It's going to be made whole. And so we toil, we labor, and we do these things for the glory of God because he will fulfill all of that. He will give us his answer from an eternal perspective. It all has meaning. Nothing is hevel under the heavens. In 2 Corinthians 4:17, the Apostle Paul, who was beaten and stoned and whipped and shipwrecked and all these things in prison, he says this: our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. This life might be hard and it might be brutal and painful. He says, this is momentary. This is light in comparison to what Jesus and God went through. And we can enjoy him for all of eternity. Secondly, are we present? Are we present here and now? Or do we long for the day? Can we just not wait until our kids go back to school? I struggle with that. Man, once my kids are in school, then I'll finally be able to work the way I want to work. Then I'll be able to, whatever, right? Fill in the blank. There's that day in the future or the good old days. Or do we realize that Jesus is present with you now, whether you get what you want or don't get what you want? Whether all of your greatest dreams and fantasies are fulfilled, Jesus is with you now, here. Every week at Lower Town, we have communion. It's a time to take these elements, a little wafer that represents the body of Jesus that was broken for us, the juice that represents his blood that was spilt for us, that covers our sins he paid for. And he says, this is my body, this is my blood. You take, eat, and you do this in remembrance of me. Eat it, taste it, feel it, see it. I'm here, present with you now. I did this for you. This is the point. Jesus says, I know your suffering because I know suffering. I know your rejection because I've been rejected. I know the feeling of what's the point of all of this. I get it. I see you. I hear you. I know you. And so now we get to remember here, now together as a family, the finished work of Jesus on the cross. You don't need to be a member of this church or any church. All it asks is that you're a follower of Jesus. And if you're a follower of Jesus, you're going to have those moments where you're going to ask yourself the question, what is the point? And Jesus is going to say, I am. I'm the point. And at times you're going to doubt it. You're going to struggle with it. You're going to question it. And he's going to still say, I get it. Hold fast to me. We're about to sing a couple songs. I didn't talk to Zach about this, but we're going to sing some songs that deal with this. Whether I'm on a mountaintop or in a valley, no matter what's going on, God, I need you. We need Jesus now all the time. And so we can take these elements together and remember what it is that Christ did for us. Let me pray. Father, thank you for our time together. Thank you that you give meaning to the dash, that you give meaning to our lives. And so much of us, and God, I just want to pray. I want to pray specifically for individuals in this room who have not just felt that in the past, but are feeling that now, that are questioning everything, that are just asking and saying, looking to the future, whether it's some change or maybe even the end of it all, that you would just meet them where they're at and say, I get it. I know what you're going through. And they would see you as they taste these elements, as they touch them and remember the finished work of you on the cross, that we would all, our prayer would be, I need thee every hour in joy or pain, whether I'm able to play the glad game or whether I'm not. You are in control and you are good. You are good. God, would you help us not forget that? We love you, and it's in Christ's name we pray.